And now, the Stanford Storytelling Project presents, as an addendum to the show Living in the Panopticon, an interview with Andrew Altschul by Jonah Willingens.
What was the inspiration for the story?
Well, I think I wanted to write about a mood that I guess I find myself in once in a while when I'm dealing with telephone queues or very long lines or bureaucratic processes. And I don't know if this is true in an objective sense, but it seems to me that in the last 5 or 6 years, the world has gotten a lot more difficult to deal with bureaucratically, and there's that particular feeling of frustration that you have, where it's not just impatience or even frustration, but it is a complete helplessness, a feeling that you absolutely must do something, but you are being prevented from accomplishing it by systems that have that you have no control over, and that it's not clear who has control over. These seem to have organically developed themselves with the goal of driving you completely out of your mind. So I wanted to write something about that mood. And as far as what the catalyst was for, there was a period of about 2 weeks when I was living in upstate New York in the dead of winter, when my phone started ringing, not in the way that it did in this story, but maybe 3 or 4 times a day for about a week or 10 days. And it was clearly some kind of automated dialer which was trying to find a fax machine. And so I would get this tone. And, you know, I, of course, just turned the volume down and didn't go postal on anybody, but I thought that was a good starting place to write about this kind of feeling that I'm talking about.
It feels to me that the story begins in and stays in some sense in realism. We feel that there's, you know, grounding details, but we're always given just enough to kind of empathize or identify with the character, but never more than that. So it almost seems like the genre exists somewhere in between kind of a realist story and allegory, or something that we might say magical realist or something like that. Did you set out in the beginning to create something that was beyond a normal realist story in the way that we usually think of?
Well, I was very lucky with this story in that I knew how it sounded. Right away, I knew what I wanted it to sound like, and it would be this kind of breathless, clipped, verging on paranoid kind of voice to the story. You know, you mentioned magic realism, and Garcia Marquez famously says, you know, everything I've ever written about is true. And it's, I think what that speaks to is that. You know, this story feels very realistic to me, not in the sense that it really happened or even necessarily that it could happen just like this, but that this is the world we live in. It's a world in which we get caught up in thousands of systems and networks that we can only see tiny pieces of, if that. And to these systems and networks, we are completely anonymous. We are numbers, or we are credit cards, or images on a surveillance camera. So the protagonist of the story, his name is F, F period, which I think is meant to convey that kind of anonymity that the larger world conveys to him, is his complete lack of identity. Is that in the realism genre? I don't know. I just know that how often I feel completely anonymous to great parts of the world that I have to deal with every day.
I've been recently teaching some students passages from Marshall McLuhan, and his vision is that in the mid and late 60s is that all of the technology will connect us and lead to this global village. So we both probably grew up with this phrase of the medium is the message and the global village.
But somehow I had come to hear that phrase as more ominous than it sounds now coming out of your mouth.
Yeah. Well, I think that in the underlying his theory was this idea that man was extending himself, his sensorium, through all these technologies. But for me and McLuhan, there's always this idea that the opposite is happening too. And so it seems to me like what you're describing and what I took away from the story was this sense that these characters and us very realistically are becoming kind of relays in a circuit, in a anonymous kind of component parts of something. And is there a reason that I wonder, it just seemed to me appropriate that you chose the communication system.
Well, is there anything now in our world that can't be described as part of the communication system? I mean, you have your iPhone and your iPod that are now hooked into your car, and you have Bluetooth everything. I mean, you can balance your checkbook online while taking a shower in Micronesia. Everything is communication. What the young man at the end of the story, the customer service representative, finally says to him is not untrue. He says, you know, modern telephone systems are more productive or more efficient now than they've ever been, and in the future they will be more so. Well, that's probably true, and there are probably a lot of executives of telephone companies and probably even some regular citizens who feel like that's something to really stand up and cheer for. It scares the hell out of me. You know, I have a cell phone and a landline. I have 3 or 4 different email accounts, some of which have 1 or 2 different handles to them. Is it easier for me now to stay in touch with my friends who live in Peru? Yes. Do I feel closer and more socially involved with my friends who live across the street? Absolutely not. I think it's a truism, but it's seems absolutely true to me that all of this interconnectivity really drives us apart in significant ways. Many of my students and some of my friends are very active on Facebook and MySpace, and they talk about how great it is and how they have 612 friends on Facebook, but they've never met 90% of those, and they talk about how they talk to their friends on Facebook, and I end up feeling like a 90-year-old crotchety old grandfather when I say, that's not talking. That's not conversing with people. That's typing to a screen that you've decided to pretend represents another human being. And it really is terrifying to me. That makes me sound like a Luddite, I know. But I find it terribly ominous and terribly puts a lot of distance between people.
One of the things that I found remarkable about this story is that while it has a kind of dystopic vision and this character is clearly experiencing tremendous powerlessness and a kind of something that turns into an obsession for him, but we can all understand that obsession, it never feels dark enough for me to feel depressed, like I want to stop reading. And I wondered what you see in the craft of the story that keeps us from that, that keeps us engaged and sympathetic with the character and wanting to know where it's going to go.
That I don't know. I think it's pretty darn dark all the way through. I hesitate at using dystopic for the same reason I hesitated to say it departs from realism. It doesn't. It feels topic to me. Neither you nor dis. But I think that many of the best and most classic stories ever written or passed down orally are quest stories. You know, somebody wants something or they need something, and they are going to set out to get it. And if you make that quest visceral enough, comprehensible enough, and urgent enough, I think people will keep reading, however dark or depressing it might be.
I'm really impressed with the sense of nervousness, and we mentioned this before we went on the air, about the kind of nervy quality and the way that you performed the piece with that speed, how that drew upon the rhythm and the syntax of the story. Can you describe a little bit about what went into the language and the syntax that created that mood that you mentioned?
Well, like I was saying, this was one of those very, very lucky stories that I wrote rather quickly. I think the whole thing, or the first draft of it, was written in less than a week. I revised it several times, but I heard it in my head. That's always the most important thing for me, is I can't really get a story off the ground until I hear what its voice really is. And this one I knew right away. And I wish that I could say it's because I'm such a tuned in and conscious and brilliant writer that I, you know, crunched the information in my head of the kind of story I wanted to write and came out with the answer of it should sound this way or that way. But it's not. It's just that this was the material I wanted to write about, and as soon as I sat down at the computer, I could hear that kind of rhythm. And so it was not really a conscious process the first time through in giving it that rhythm, that kind of clipped and breathless and slightly panicked feel to it. It was how I was hearing the lines in my head as they went through my fingers into the keyboard. Then in the revision process, of course, I can sit down and say, oh yes, this is technically how that sound in my head got translated onto the page, and I can enhance it or bump it up in certain places or modulate it more consciously so that it does some of the things I want it to do more successfully. But the way it sounds now is pretty darn near how it sounded in my head when I wrote the first line.
My last question really kind of follows on this idea of how the material has come to you. I wondered, since I know that you've just finishing your first novel, would you say that your experience writing the novel is similar, or that you
no.
the parts not at all?
No, it's to me, the difference between a novel and a short story is as drastic as the difference between a short story and a lyric poem. They're completely different art forms. The approach to writing them is completely different. I mean, they share certain things, as do poems. Novels and short stories do, in terms of needing to provide a certain amount of narrative coherence, a certain amount of orientation to the reader, some of the most basic criteria for what makes a complete story or a complete novel are not dissimilar, but the process of creating a novel is radically different. The entire psychology for you as the writer, certainly the amount of time is much different, but that's not merely a simple truth. The fact that the composition of a novel can stretch out over a year and a half, 2.5, 3.5, 5 years has tremendous ramifications for how the story actually gets onto the page and what your mind does with the story. It's possible to write a short story, and from writing the first line to writing the last line, your general idea about what that story is has not changed much. You might discover that certain characters are more important than you thought they were. You might discover some themes emerging that you hadn't been conscious of when you were first writing it. But you set out to write a story, and if all goes well, you write that story. A novel, by the time you finish it, has morphed, has gone through stages of evolution, you know, until much of it has nothing to do with what you originally thought you were going to write, and characters come in and out of it, and settings change drastically. And to control all of that, to keep juggling that successfully without having balls dropping and bouncing on the floor everywhere, just takes a completely different set of mental and artistic muscles, I think, than writing a short story.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was wonderful speaking with you.
Nice to hear you.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.